Mystery of mysteries, saith the preacher. All is mystery. Be opening your Bibles again this morning to the Old Testament book, Ecclesiastes. Of course, it is the book that follows the Psalms and the Proverbs. This Old Testament book was originally a sermon by one of history's wisest men, Solomon. His subject was the mystery of life. And his thesis was this, and I trust that you will remember and particularly be very conscious of the thesis of Solomon's sermon. His thesis was, life here on earth is a complex mystery that none of us can hope fully to explain or understand. And if any of you want to challenge that thesis, he would give to you several of his examples. Do you remember some of the illustrations that he used of that fact? The enigma of retirement and old age. How do you explain that illustration that he gave? Or the paradox of outward visible success and failure? Or capricious death? How would you explain his illustration of capricious death? When death keeps such sloppy appointment books, comes to some people when it seems that they are at the very zenith of life with everything ready to offer, and others live on to mental senility and physical disability and still live on. Mystery of mysteries, life is a mystery. That's the thesis of this preacher, Solomon. That life is a mystery that none of us is going to be fully able to explain or even understand. He was not saying that the events of life have no good purpose or plan. Please make the distinction. Rather, he was saying that you and I, who are in the midst of life, are not going to be able to see that plan and design. He was declaring that you and I need to acknowledge and accept the fact that there are going to be many things in this life whose purpose or good reason we will be completely unable to grasp. And this preacher wants us to be able to accept that fact. He wants us to be able to face life and to accept the fact that there will be innumerable events of life we will not be able now to understand. That's his thesis. And of course, that's expressed in other parts of the scripture as well, not just by this preacher. You remember how the psalmist David declared, O Lord, how great are thy works, and your thoughts are very deep. Remember how through the prophet Isaiah, the Lord himself said, For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Can you accept that fact? Or do you believe you have to explain and be able to understand all of life? You see, there are some Christians who believe that life shouldn't even have these kinds of events, that if you're really walking with the Lord and actually in fellowship with Him, that it is never the will of God that a Christian have those kinds of experiences. And that if you have that kind of an experience, a physical problem and illness and sickness and disability or some other kind of a trouble, that if you actually believed God as you should and trusted Him as you ought to, that it would not be God's will for you to have that kind of an experience at all. Now, this preacher would never agree to that kind of theology. Not only would he not agree to that theology, but there are then others who would say, yes, I can see that the Bible teaches that we will, even when we trust God and believe in Him and walk in obedience to Him, that there will be difficult trouble experiences, but I think that we can understand them, and I can always give an explanation to everyone for the reason. And so they feel they always can offer an adequate reason to everyone for the things that come into life. This preacher would disagree with that too. He not only would say there are going to be experiences that are difficult and enigmas in your life, even as you walk with the Lord, but there are going to be many of those whose good purpose and reason you will never be able to grasp in this life. Mystery of mysteries, all is mystery. Life is mystery. That's his thesis. And if any of you want to challenge that, I'd like you to explain some of his illustrations. Now, having said that, what should be one's procedure with life? If that is true, how should we respond, and what should be our procedure? As you now have your Bibles open, I trust, to the book of Ecclesiastes, I would like to point out how in chapters 1 and 2, Solomon, this preacher, describes how he had tried to find the procedure and the solution in several different ways. And in the first two chapters, he describes some of those ways that he had sought to explain the meaning and answer of life. Actually, in verses 1 through 11, he literally says that he tried, first of all, natural science. He studied nature. He studied natural science. Let me read to you some of the selected verses. Verse 5 and following. The sun also riseth and goeth down and hasteth to its place where it rose. The wind goes toward the south and turneth about to the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to its circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. In a moment we'll read some more of these verses. But actually, Solomon begins to describe here how he first of all began to study nature, and he began to study natural science. And he discovered that natural science could not give him the answers to life. He said nature is a cycle. The rains fall, the rivers flow, the oceans fill, the sun evaporates, the clouds gather, the winds blow them back over the mountains where they are cooled, and the water condenses, and the rains fall, and the rivers fill and flow, and the oceans fill, and it goes over and over and over again. Nature gave him no answers at all. It may display God's glory, but it did not give the explanation to life. That's what he is saying in these first 11 verses. Incidentally, these verses are quite impressive because they indicate that Solomon understood the hydrologic cycle or the water cycle, which is something that natural science has only begun to understand actually in this present century. Up as recently as the 19th century or the 18th century, the dogma of science was that somehow when the rivers flowed into the ocean, that the oceans flowed by subterranean rivers back underneath the mountains, and there in some unusual way they were purified and rose to the springs, and through the springs they flowed back into the rivers and back into the oceans. If you want to read about this, read your Encyclopedia Britannica. Look up, for example, in an Encyclopedia Britannica, the phrase the hydrologic cycle. They will trace for you the history of this development. And they will point out to you that only in the 20th century has science begun to understand what is called the water or hydrologic cycle and the great wind circuits and how this whole process goes on. And it goes on in exactly the way that Solomon described it here. 3,000 years ago, he studied nature, and he found that the waters fall into the rivers, they flow into the ocean. There in the ocean, the sun evaporates the water, and the clouds gather, and the great wind circuits, you will notice that in verse 6 and verse 7, and how the wind circuits follow their natural path, and they blow the clouds back over the mountains, where they are cooled and condensed, and again, the waterfalls and the rivers are filled, etc. He describes that great scientific principle. But it didn't give him any answer to life. He said, for example, that natural science could give him nothing new under the sun. That's verse 9 and 10. The thing that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new, it hath been already of old time which was before us? Science could show him only what was already there and could give no answers to life. History could tell him what occurred, and science could tell him how it occurred, but neither could tell him why it occurred. And that's what he says, for example, in the 11th verse. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. None of these could be given to him in the study of natural science. They failed. Young people here today can be trapped by that, especially since there are so many teachers. I have high regard for our teachers, and I don't want to be misunderstood, but unfortunately so many teachers are not nearly as profound and scholarly as they ought to be, and young people are being trapped because of the fact that science and technology have done so much for us into thinking that technology and science have the ultimate answers, and any profound thinker knows they do not. Young people, with all the great respect we ought to have for science and the study of science and human technology, please don't be deceived into thinking that it's got the answers. As Solomon said, it can tell you what has happened and how it happened, but it never can tell you why it happened. Then he said in verses 12 through 18 that he turned to philosophy. Notice verse 12 and 13. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. Solomon actually is declaring that after he studied nature and science, he then turned to philosophy, to wisdom. Because philosophy at least purports to deal with what are called the ultimate concerns. The subject of philosophy and wisdom is such things as, who am I? Why am I here? Where am I headed? And what is my reason for existing? So Solomon said he next turned to philosophy and to wisdom to try to find the answer. And what he discovered was this, that philosophy will show you that there are enormous problems, but philosophy will admittedly say they do not know the answers. And that's what we find at the end of verse 13 and following. Notice, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. And what did he find? This severe travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, it's vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is lacking cannot be numbered. He was saying here that when he studied philosophy, he discovered that philosophy can make you very aware of the enormous problems, but it does not offer the answers. Verse 15, that which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is lacking cannot be numbered. You know what I have discovered? Because I, like many of you, have spent probably many a college hour reading and studying philosophy. Apart from philosophers who have a deep faith in God, in Jesus Christ, I think most of you will find that philosophers as a whole are the most pessimistic, depressed people there are. They are aware of the enormous problems, more than you and I are often aware. They have become aware of the tremendous dangers to life on this earth. They have become conscious of the great inequities that exist among man. They have become aware of the tremendous distribution of wealth and the inequity of the distribution of wealth. They have become very conscious of racial discrimination. They have become extremely aware of the dangers to mankind that exist in its future survival upon the earth. But almost without exception, if not without exception, they admittedly are very aware of the problems, but say, we don't know the answers. They have become more aware of the problems than you and I have allowed ourselves to become aware. The discouraging thing that I often find is that sometimes we as Christians can live in the midst of a world where there are such enormous injustices and problems and dangers, and we have not allowed ourselves even to become aware of them. Philosophers are enormously aware of the problems, but they say, we don't know the answers to these problems. And that's why that Solomon said toward the end of this passage that knowledge brings grief. Notice what he wrote at the very end, verse 16 and following. I spoke to my own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they who have been before me in Jerusalem. Yes, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom, philosophy. And it knew madness and folly. I perceived it was just vexation of spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. There are some senses in which ignorance is bliss. And I want to assure you that one of the most distressing things that will come to you will be to study the problems of life and become aware of them. And the philosopher is often a man, usually a man, who has thought about and observed the great ultimate problems of life, has found no answer. They're bigger than he knows how to solve. And with his much learning has come grief and sorrow. One of the leading philosophers at the University of Oklahoma, under whom I studied 5 or 6 years ago, was a man who on several occasions said, at times I'm almost committed, almost inclined to take my life, because I have become aware of the problems and dangers and inequities of life, and I do not know the answers. That's what Solomon said. He tried natural science. It displayed the glory of God. It was a cycle. No answers. He turned to philosophy, and he found that all philosophy did was make him more aware of the problems, but had no answers. And let me say to you that if ever that were true, it is true today. Back in the 18th century, there was the rise of what is known as rationalism and empiricism. It was the forerunner of science and scientism. For a couple of decades, people thought that finally man has found the way, because they said through rationalism and empiricism, man will be able, by observation and experimentation and taking that which is observable and can handle, man can solve the problems of this world. And there was a couple of decades of enormous optimism. Man will now, by science, solve the problems of this world. And anyone who is at least 50 years behind times will still think that. But my friends, the great thinkers of the world today don't hold that anymore. The great philosophers of the world today have said, we're thankful for science, but science doesn't have the answers. In the 19th century, there arose, particularly in German, the philosophy of phenomenology, because philosophers began to say science can't answer our problems. And they rejected scientism as the answer, and there began the philosophy of phenomenology, that is, that the most immediate and reliable data that you have is the phenomena of your own organism. Your own experience and thought is immediate data, and it's the most reliable data that you can have. It is truth, phenomenology. And out of phenomenology grew the philosophy of existentialism. They finally said, this must be the answer. We can't rely upon science and empiricism and rationalism any longer to solve the problems of man, but the answer is to take our own phenomenology, our own physical experience, and let that be the real reality. And out of it grew existentialism. And today, existentialism is called what? The philosophy of despair. If you want to read the best description of the human predicament that there is, you read existentialism. It could be taken from the Bible. I don't know anybody who can describe the human predicament as well as an existentialist. But he has no answers. And therefore, today, philosophy is saying it's a philosophy of despair. That's what Solomon said. Right here in verses 12 through 18. I turned from science to philosophy, and my conclusion was this. In much wisdom, verse 18, is much grief. And he who increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Chapter 2. He turned to hedonism and materialism. Let me quickly read, beginning at verse 3. I'll read selected parts of this second chapter in the first 9 verses. I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heavens all the days of their life. I made for myself great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kind of fruits. I made pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of herds and flocks above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered silver and gold, and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. So I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and that was my portion of all my labor. Having turned from science to philosophy, he turned to hedonism. And he said, I sought to satisfy every desire that I had. I felt that if I could satisfy myself in every physical way, that perhaps that would give to me the answer to life and its meanings. And he concluded in verse 11 that physiological gratification is just a transitory sensation. I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on all the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, it was just a vexation of spirit. It was just a transitory sensation of the body. Now, there are a lot of us who don't really think that that's valid. There are a lot of you here this morning who are thinking, deep down in your heart, if I could really satisfy every desire that I have, that would really be the answer to life. I know that's the human heart's thought. But you see, ladies and gentlemen, as Abraham Maslow, the secular psychologist, has said, there's an hierarchy of needs in the human life. There are basic physiological needs, but when they're satisfied, there still exists some other needs. And those other needs are not satisfied when the physiological needs have been met. The physiological needs can be satiated, and when they have passed away, in the heart and mind of a man, there still is the thought, is that all there is to life? Is that what life is? Is life to feed my hunger and satisfy my body? Is that what life is? And having had it all, to conclude, if that's what life really isn't worth it. Because there is a hierarchy of needs in the human being. The need to have to know, what is life about? Surely there's something more than to satisfy the physiological part of my being. And that's what this preacher said. He said, I tried that. And I discovered that it was pure vexation of spirit, just a temporary physiological sensation. And when it was over, it was empty and meaningless. What, therefore, we will go on to the answers that he gave. This preacher said that he discovered that it is possible to live life victoriously and meaningfully by a threefold faith in God. This was his experience. And I am persuaded myself that this is valid for anyone. A threefold faith in God that faces the mystery of life and enables a man to live this life victoriously and meaningfully and with contentment. The first thing that he said was, the first key is to come to know that God is sovereign, that God was in control, and that God had a plan. Even though that preacher himself could not see the plan or could not put the puzzle together, he said, I came to understand that the first answer to life is to come to be persuaded that God is a sovereign God and God has a plan. Now, if you can come to understand what that means, and if you can come to be persuaded that it is true, the only way that a human being can live this life with any kind of victory and contentment and joy is to come to understand and be persuaded of the sovereignty of God. Look at what he said in chapter 3. I am persuaded that many people have misunderstood the third chapter. Many people have said that chapter 3 simply reflects the view of a natural man, a human perspective, who says that there is a time for everything. Actually, I believe the preacher in chapter 3 is saying that that is true because every bit of it has fit into a perfect plan. There is a time to be born, to die, to plant, etc. And verse 11 sums it up. It is true because God hath made every beautiful in its time. And not only that, He has set eternity in our heart. Even though we cannot find out, we want to know the work that God is doing from the beginning to end. He has put that question in our heart to know, but God has made it beautiful. That is, everything that occurs fits into a perfect plan. And God has either permitted it or directed it. And if He has permitted it, it is because it ultimately fits a perfect plan. He has made everything beautiful. It all fits a perfect plan. Not everything in itself is good. Not everything in itself God has directed. But everything God has either permitted or directed, and in permitting or directing it, He has made every part of it beautiful because it's a part of a perfect plan. God is sovereign. And if you don't come to be persuaded of that, you will never be able to face this life with any degree of equanimity. But if you are persuaded that everything has its time because God has made everything to be a part of His perfect plan, you can first of all be prepared to face life and its mystery. You want to know of tremendous illustration of that in the Scriptures. Let me give you one quickly. Turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 4. In the fourth chapter of Daniel, we have another world ruler. Ecclesiastes, we had Solomon, the preacher who was also the king of Israel at the height of Israel's power. Chapter 4 of Daniel, verses 28 and following, we have Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king over great Babylon. Another great world ruler who lived, of course, several centuries after Solomon. Verse 28, I want you to notice the words of this chapter, which are so amazing. All this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spoke and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? If there's anything Nebuchadnezzar is denying here, it is the sovereignty of God. He is saying, this is what man has done. The good that comes, man has done it. And the good that fails to come, it's because man hasn't done it. This is what I have done. Not that God is in control, but by my might and my power, I have done this. Now notice verse 31 and following. While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken. Your kingdom is departed from you. They will drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you to eat grass like oxen, and seven times will pass over you until you know what? Until you learn that God is sovereign. Verse 33, the same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and did eat grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven. He lived in the open like an animal, till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and my understanding returned unto me. And what happened? I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, His kingdom from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are as nothing in His power as far as His power is concerned. Verse 36, at the same time, my reason returned unto me. And verse 37, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the God, the King of heaven, whose words are truth and His ways are justice, and those who walk in pride He is able to abase. Nebuchadnezzar said, I became insane. At the time that I thought I had done it all, When I felt that I had built it all, I became an insane man. And when my reason returned unto me, I said, God is sovereign. Everything that comes to life, it is a sovereign God. You can never, ever face this life. You may right now, you may have been one of those people to this point in life has escaped relatively lightly. But my friend, it is almost sure that at times you're going to be touched with things that you will say, I do not understand. I cannot see how this can be good. Unless you are persuaded in your heart that God is sovereign and everything that occurs, He has either permitted or directed because He has a plan that is the absolute perfect plan. That's the sovereignty of God. The two other answers to this that are so important, perhaps I'll teach them next week.